Welcome back, everyone. We're returning from a brief lunch break. This is Cases from the Community, integrating new research findings into clinical practice in oncology. Again, this is a multi-tumor symposium in partnership with the American Oncology Network. We have successfully navigated three modules thus far. We're now blessed to have Dr. Moore with us. We're going to discuss gynecologic cancers. Dr. Kathleen Moore is Director of Clinical Research at the Virginia Curley Chair in Developmental Therapeutics at the Stevenson Cancer Center at the University of Oklahoma. She's also Associate Director for GOG Partners and on the Board of Directors of the GOG Foundation. Hopefully he's going to get our Oklahoma football team back on track for this year.
I cannot.
That remains to be seen. These are Dr. Moore's disclosures and mine. And again, we sort of provide some backdrop with data from the Meaningful Insights and Biotech Analytics, the AI data company that actually looks at the networks, individual patients. Here you can see for ovarian, endometrial, and cervical cancer, the number of patients throughout the network, including newly diagnosed ovarian, and what the testing rates look like for NGS and also specifically for BRCA status. Here's a snapshot from the individual practice on utilization of olaparib and mirvetuximab, as well as PARP inhibitors in various lines of therapy. We're going to go through some data that makes this a little more relevant. These are the patients, that have been tested for HER2-positive disease, given the data we have with T-DXd in this space. We also have some super exciting and interesting data regarding MSI status and endometrial cancer and cervical cancer. We're going to highlight that. But first, we're going to start with a case by Dr. Lamar and a few specific questions, which will sort of stimulate our thought as we go through the data.
The next case is presented by Dr. Lamar, a 63-year-old woman with abdominal fullness who was found to have an ovarian mass.
She had a CT scan that actually showed a 6-centimeter cystic and solid mass. She underwent an exploratory laparotomy, and actually the mass was even larger than was seen on the CT scan. It was a 12-centimeter mass. Complete hysterectomy, total omentectomy, optimal tumor debulking. And the pathology from the tumor showed high-grade serous carcinoma with extensive necrosis. Three lymph nodes were involved. Her genetic testing was negative. So she is BRCA negative. Her HRD status is pending. Assuming HRD proficiency, how do you determine whether or not you proceed with maintenance therapy in these patients? And which maintenance therapy do you use? A PARP inhibitor combined with bevacizumab versus observation or bevacizumab alone? And the next question is, if you use a PARP inhibitor, how do you determine which one you use? The third question is, instead of bevacizumab, do you ever consider other VEGF inhibitors, such as pazopanib or nintedanib? A lot of medical oncologists don't have great gyn-onc training. I mean, we know carboplatin, but I would be curious her algorithm of second and third line therapies, how she thinks about it.
Super fantastic way to set the stage for the data we're going to go through with Solo and Paolo and Prima, but also makes a fantastic point, right, Dr. Moore? Gyn-onc for the med-onc was pretty simple. We just had to remember carboplatin for a long time. Those days are over, right? I mean, and so now we move forward. So these are the questions we'll think through as you go through the data and circle back to these. We also have some new targets that we'll be discussing, including cadherin-6 and antibody-drug conjugates targeting that.
Right. So we'll come back to these questions. I will try to ping them as we hit each of the relevant data points so we can kind of put them in context. But you're absolutely right. And I love speaking with medical oncologists. I don't know how you do it. I'm really honest. I don't know how general medical oncologists do it. It's so complicated. And when I sit in these meetings and sit at ASCO and ESMO, it's just overwhelming in each disease site, much less across all the disease sites. So I always really genuinely appreciate to have a little bit of your time to talk about what I'm passionate about, which is gynecologic cancers. And it's even hard for us, you know, and it's gotten much more multidisciplinary. I collaborate with my medical oncology colleagues at Stevenson Cancer Center much more than I ever have around some of these targeted therapies and the management of the toxicities. So I think we're just in a team-based world now. And we just need to all work together.
But it's a village.
It's a village. It is a village now. And that's for the betterment of our patients. And it's sort of what I titled my talk. I was asked to speak about ovarian, endometrial, and cervical advances in 25 minutes. And I think I sent Dr. Love like 85 slides because there's so much that's happened just in the last 3 years. And he made me pare it down. So I'm going to try and get through the high points. But I'm going to talk about ovary, endometrial, and cervical cancer highlights. And I'm going to start with ovary. And, you know I look so young, but I've been doing this for 20 years. And I remember a time when, I was kidding about looking young. I remember a time when, you're supposed to laugh, when I was in early practice, all epithelial ovarian cancer was just lumped together and everyone got paclitaxel and carboplatin for 6 or 8 cycles. And that's what we did. And now we really understand, much like a lot of solid tumors, that it is a biomarker-directed world, and epithelial ovarian cancer is probably 8 or 9 different diseases that eventually we'll be able to individualize therapy for. So I'm really focused here on high-grade serous and high-grade endometrioid and what we've learned, and it really is a biomarker-directed world, and I'm going to take you through this data by biomarker, starting with BRCA. Either germline or somatic, there really is no difference thus far that we can tell in the predictive capability of either a somatic or a germline mutation informing use of PARP inhibitors. So I'm showing you not even all the studies, but just the representative ones. Solo one is on the left, and I had the great honor of co-leading this with Paul DiSilvestro. This is the only study that was only in BRCA. And then Paola one and Prima had BRCA subsets. And these are the progression-free survival curves. And what you can see here is very consistent, subset or not, the hazard ratio is 0.3 to 0.4. So a 60 to 70% reduction in the hazard of progression. When we use PARP inhibitor maintenance, either olaparib or niraparib, we have data now for rucaparib as well, versus placebo, following induction chemotherapy with paclitaxel and carboplatin. And the red stars are really kind of showing the places where these, you know, kind of how far out we followed these patients. And I just wanted to point out the plateaus. You know, these are patients, these are progression-free survival curves. So these are the patients that are not really having event rates. And we do wonder about cure here. So there is a percentage of patients for the first time ever, we really think we are curing with this biomarker selected group. What's it look like for overall survival? Well, largely we have not reached maturity. I'm showing you Solo 1 on the left, which has not yet reached medians. This was a pre-planned 7-year interim analysis, and you can see at 7 years, the percentage who are alive, not alive without disease, but alive, is 67% in the olaparib group versus 46% in the placebo group. This was not statistically significant because the amount, the alpha was set so stringently because it was an interim analysis, you know, that we would never have met it. But I think you can tell they are different. In Paola 1, this is the pre-specified 5-year landmark cut. Again, this was not statistically designed to look at it with event rates because it takes so long to get there. But this was statistically significantly improved overall survival. And we just saw Prima readout at ESMO a few weeks ago, and this is niraparib versus placebo. This is the last study to be completed. And somewhat surprisingly, we do not see an overall survival advantage here. There's no detriment either, but we are all a little puzzled about this. Although I will say that the crossover rate at the time of progression in this study was the highest of any of these three studies, and that will impact overall survival. In Solo 1, it was about 44%, similar in Paola 1, it was almost 70% in Prima. And so that may have impacted this, but we're going to have to be thinking about this for a while longer. How about HRD test negative, or I'm sorry, BRCA negative, but HRD test positive? These are all subset looks, but they're very consistent with a hazard ratio of about 0.5, so about a 50% reduction in the hazard of progression or death with use of PARP inhibitor in this population. Overall survival, also a little bit unstable. I'm showing you PAOLA-1 on the left and PRIMA again. This is very recent data on the right. We do see a nominal improvement in this population, certainly no detriment in the PAOLA study. You can see the landmark of patients who are alive, 55 versus 44%. That was how this was statistically designed. On the right-hand side is PRIMA, which again does not show any improvement in overall survival. Fortunately, we didn't see a detriment either. And I think it just speaks to the fact that post-progression survival is quite long, fortunately, in ovarian cancer, and the crossover rate was quite high. Now, our biggest high unmet need, and this kind of comes back to the case, is these group of tumors that are BRCA wild type and also HRD test negative. And this is about 50% of high-grade serous ovarian cancer. This is not a small subset. And PAOLA-1, these are PFS curves, PAOLA-1 on the left, which was olaparib bevacizumab versus bevacizumab. So an active control, absolutely no improvement in PFS in this population. PRIMA, which was niraparib versus placebo, did show a statistically, and some would say clinically relevant improvement in progression-free survival. The hazard ratio was 0.67, so a 33% reduction in the hazard of progression with use of niraparib, and that did lead to the all-comers indication. But I think we can also agree that it's a modest improvement, and HRD test negative tumors, if you look at these curves, really are quite a poor prognostic group of tumors, and we need to understand why, what's driving that if we're really going to do better. Here's the overall survival for these two studies in these subset analyses. These are subsets, which is why there's not p-values here, but you can see we're kind of running in about the median kind of three-year mark. For median overall survival with really no benefit in either study with the addition of a PARP inhibitor here. And so it really does call to question in this group, even though it's authorized. You know, what would I do here? Back to our excellent question at the beginning. I think it really is individualized by the patient. For most patients, for me, I talk to them about bevacizumab. I do talk to them about PARP inhibitor because I'm not going to hide things from patients, but we kind of know the phenotype of the patients who might benefit from PARP in this biomarker-directed group. You know, patients who are getting neoadjuvant and they respond beautifully to the platinum, but they're HRD test negative, yeah, I might try a PARP there because there's something phenotypically about that tumor that still has some deficiency in how it repairs its DNA. More often, we see patients whose CA125s are slowly coming down. If you like the KLM CA125 algorithm, they have an unfavorable KLM. I really don't think there's any benefit to PARP in that population, and I'm going to use bevacizumab. And more importantly, we need clinical research and trials to do better here. It's sort of like fitting a square peg in a round hole. I'm trying to use a PARP inhibitor here, in my opinion. So I think more to come in that space.
Perfect. In the HRD population that test positive, your frontline preference?
My frontline preference right now is PARP inhibitors because I do really believe that they benefit. I think the chemo-free interval is important, but I also think there's clinical equipoise there. There are patients that are BRCA wild-type HRD test positive that do amazing, and there's also these tumors that just do terrible. And we're trying to figure out how to predict those because it may be that we need to do something else, targeting replication stress, ATR inhibitors, WEE1 kinase, if we can ever get those to be safe, CHK2. There's a number of agents that may be better, kind of blasphemy to say. But right now I'd use PARP, and I feel very confident about it right now. But I also say that we probably can do better in that population because we're not curing the majority, if any, of that population. And Until we can do that, we can do better, I think.
You got some new stuff for us, right?
New stuff. So that's frontline, and watch for clinical trials. I'm going to kind of skip the platinum-sensitive recurrent space, although I'll come back to it in a moment, but I'm going to jump right to the platinum-resistant space. So these are tumors for whom we think platinum is no longer indicated. And this is really where we do a lot of our drug development initially, and then sort of move things forward. And it's been a place where we have not had any successes since the Aurelia regimen, which was chemotherapy and bevacizumab. That study was presented 12 years ago. That was our last approval in the platinum resistant space based on a PFS improvement alone, no OS, until this year. With mirvetuximab in the Mirasol study, this is the new standard of care for platinum resistant recurrent ovarian cancer that is folate receptor alpha high. And this is done usually centrally tested, although some hospitals are doing this locally now. It's defined as a tumor that has folate receptor alpha expression in 75% or more of the cells that are on the slide of 2+ intensity or greater. Medium is 50 to 75, and then low is 25 to 50%. So there's, this is the CDX for mirvetuximab. There's a number of ADCs targeting folate, and they're all going to have their own CDX. So kind of buckle up for that confusion. But this is mirvetuximab. This approval was based on two studies. First, the SORAYA study, which was a single arm accelerated approval, that really got it approved in the United States about a year earlier than the confirmed approval. And then the Mirasol trial, which was a randomized phase 3 clinical trial comparing mirvetuximab to investigator's choice chemotherapy, 1 to 3 prior lines of therapy. And these were the results that I actually had the great privilege of leading this study. We had a statistically and clinically significant improvement in progression-free survival with a hazard ratio of 0.65, so a 35% reduction in the hazard of progression. Because we hit that, we could roll alpha to first overall response rate, which was one of our first secondary but analytic endpoints. The response rate was 42% versus 16%, so highly statistically and clinically significant. And because that was significant, we could roll alpha to the first interim analysis of overall survival. So this was a pre-planned interim analysis at the time of PFS readout. And for this to be called positive, the p-value would have had to been less than 0.0131. And we hit it at the first interim analysis. And so this is the final overall survival analysis, statistically significant and clinically relevant improvement in overall survival, which we have never shown ever in platinum-resistant ovarian cancer. And so the gauntlet has been thrown that we can do this with targeted therapies. And there is a like tidal wave of these sorts of studies coming now to try and bring more biomarker-directed but more widely applicable biomarkers into this space. And so this is quite exciting and is now FDA-approved in the U.S., and we have pending global approvals.
So did it take antibody-drug conjugates to get us there? Because we had the same problem in the bladder space, right? We finally got the Padcev-Pembro data. It was the first in I don't know how long to change survival. So is that a difference maker? And you're like off the cuff just...
The ADCs?
Mm-hmm.
The ADCs have been a difference maker. I think... Dr. Love made me take out again 30 of my slides, which is appropriate. But you know, I get excited because at ESMO this year we saw the first readouts, and it's 40 patient cohorts, and so we do have to have a modicum of caution, you know, adapting things right off the bat with 40 patients. But it was exciting, first readout of TROP2 ADCs, first readout of some folate exatecan ADCs. Cadherin-6, we'd presented Claudin-6. So we saw probably 4 new targets in GYN at ESMO alone that all look so much better than anything we have, that standard of care, that I think it is quite exciting. The challenge, and I'll kind of talk about this here, is really going to be just like they're talking about in breast, sequencing, how early do you move these? How long can you leave a patient on an ADC? Is it a maintenance strategy forever? Am I going to hurt somebody? You know, what are the downstream repercussions of a tumor that progresses on an ADC versus after? Like, we need those questions now. We don't have all the data yet. So the ADCs are going to transform our space, but we have a lot of work to do.
The data in platinum sensitive on that waterfall plot looks pretty salty.
This looks pretty nice. Yeah, so platinum sensitive is an evolving even... definition. You know, traditionally we said, okay, well, platinum sensitive means the tumor comes back at least 6 months after the last platinum. And we've done many studies and they're very consistent in outcomes. Now that we've moved PARP inhibitor into the front line, we have patients who have received a PARP inhibitor and their tumor progresses during the PARP. Some of those because they were going to recur anyway and the PARP had nothing to do with it. Some of them, they're recurring on a PARP and under some exposure to PARP for a number of months. And we think that that is impacting the phenotype of the tumor and how it responds to subsequent platinum. So the definitions of platinum sensitive are about to change. So we're starting to evaluate options that are not platinum, but we're going to have to put this up against platinum. So these are the first readouts. Again, we saw some data at ESMO. This was the largest study. This is the PICCOLO trial. Mirvetuximab in a folate receptor alpha high population. Again, patients had to be platinum sensitive, but have received two platinum. So it's a little bit of a different population, but many of them had received prior PARP. And we had this response rate of 52%. As a benchmark, the response to like third platinum is about 30 to 40%. So is this better? Is it just a good alternative? We don't know yet, but this was kind of a nice non-platinum based option. And I think you're going to see these roll in to some randomized studies in the next year or so. We already have the kind of first study in gyn cancers of an ADC as a maintenance, and this is the GLORIOSA study. This is open, kind of in well underway globally. Patients are first recurrent, folate receptor alpha high, and they get chemo. And as long as they have not progressed on the chemo, they get randomized to bevacizumab or bevacizumab and mirvetuximab for until progression, which I think we can second guess that. But this is an important study and is well on its way to completing accrual. And there's going to be many more like this kind of coming down the pike. We mentioned at the question at the beginning, kind of what's the role of Cadherin-6 and really what are the other targets or many other targets. I've mentioned several of them already, TROP2, HER2, Cadherin-6 is one of our leading options. Why? Because it's really just like TROP2. It's almost ubiquitous, some of it. You know, there's low, medium, and high. Does that matter? We can argue the same thing with TROP2. We don't really know yet, but it's almost ubiquitous on high-grade serous ovarian cancer, and so thus far the studies evaluating this haven't required testing. So that's why we tested it. It's moved into a clinical trial with a drug called raludotug, deruxtecan. You can call it RDXD. This was the data we presented at ESMO last year with a response rate just under 50% in a platinum-resistant population requiring prior bevacizumab. Like, these were very much what you would expect to see in a platinum-resistant population. The durability of response was just under a year, and median PFS was 8 months. So a very, very strong signal with about 50 patients for this medication. And this has moved into a registration-enabling trial that is now open globally. And I'll point out that it's complicated now because the FDA is appropriately requiring us to dose optimize before we go into phase 3 so we don't move toxic drugs into large numbers of patients. And so this phase 2 just completed accrual, or just about is, I'm not sure they've officially announced yet, but it's quite close to dose optimize between 3 active doses, and they've required biopsies so they can really figure out if they need a companion diagnostic or if this is truly an all-comer indication before it bounces into a seamless phase 3. It's not quite seamless because there's going to be a pause, but this is really patient-centered design. Safe dose, effective dose, do I need a biomarker or not? So I'm really proud of this study. It's led by Isabel Ray Cucarda and Debbie Richardson globally.
So we have the RDXD, we have TDXD. We're going to, that's why I was mentioning the ADCs in ovarian, just crazy exciting time. But and speaking of time, we're going to move forward to an endometrial cancer case presented by Dr. Warsh.
The next case is presented by Dr. Warsh.
This is a 74-year-old female, overall very healthy, presented with progressive abdominal pain and distension. She went to imaging in the emergency room, which showed malignant ascites, carcinomatosis, uterine fullness with possible uterine primary. It was felt that this definitive surgery would be pretty challenging for her. They did undergo a biopsy, which revealed adenocarcinoma. They didn't think that a full hysterectomy, debulking surgery, that the patient would be a candidate for that. I did a full NGS panel on her tumor. It did show a tumor mutation burden of 25. She was MSS. And then this combined with the fact that her ECOG status was a little bit borderline, we started her on pembrolizumab, given this approval, basically a primary agnostic indication for pembrolizumab. And slowly and surely, we saw pretty good improvement of her symptoms. She had less distension, less fullness, was able to eat a little bit more. We were talking about like a PEG tube or an NG tube to just supplement her intake because she just had so much pain and distension from the disease.
Incredible case. How long has she been on it, roughly?
Well, so at this point, it would be about 18 months.
Wow.
And another question is, what tumor mutation burden do we look for? I know above 10, it's approved, but do we think if it's 20, 30, 40, are we more confident that someone is going to respond? And I'm also curious how high you've seen it, just out of curiosity.
So a couple of questions for thought. Preferred first-line therapy in microsatellite stable, proficient mismatch repairing endometrial cancer, and the preference on PD-1s. Also, the status of HER2 testing. When should that be done? And with respect to the testing on the IHC, is 2+ versus 3+. I know the GOG updated NCCN. You guys wrote and helped us out quite a bit there versus the pan tumor. So
yeah, so that was a great case, and I'm going to try and hit a lot of the questions as I go through this data. So if I mention that ovarian cancer is a biomarker-directed world, endometrial is 100% a biomarker-directed world and becoming much more complex, we are going to learn a lot in the next few years to the betterment of our patients' outcomes, I am convinced. But just in the last 3 years, outcomes for endometrial cancer have been transformed by the addition of immune checkpoint inhibitors with chemotherapy and to follow. These are four of the studies in the deficient mismatch repair group. And I think you can see here, this looks like PARP inhibitor and BRCA. These are hazard ratios are 0.3. And there's still a group of patients, I wish I had a pointer, that we need to understand in the first 12 months who progress. And why is that? We don't know yet. We are really looking at this. But once you get to 12 months, these curves are flat. And we do wonder if some of these patients are cured. And I'll remind you that mismatch repair proficiency is not prognostic. These patients before this just died. And it's just they're not dying. It's kind of the closest to a miracle that I think I'm going to see in my career. And it kind of makes me emotional looking at it because a lot of the patients on these trials would not be above ground had they not participated. And so this is a must know for any patient with endometrial cancer. And IO is the requirement. Now, that's the minority of patients, though. The majority are proficient. And these are the studies here. All of these studies enrolled all comers and then stratified by mismatch repair status. And you can see that there is an improvement in PFS. It is statistically, and I think clinically, relevant in a group of patients whose tumors are, largely terminal. But I think you can also see this and say, well, gosh, it's like BRCA. It's like PARP in a non-BRCA. It's good, but we can do better, and we are already striving to do so. The biomarkers are going to be key. So a couple things that I want to reflect back on the case. So one question is, if I have a deficient mismatch repair tumor, and in that case it was a tumor mutation burden high, do I even need the chemo? We really do want to not use chemo if we can. That's ideal. So do we really need this? We don't know the answer yet. And I know that that was an extreme case, and I have definitely done that in patients who could not tolerate chemotherapy and been pleased with the outcome. But these are the two studies that are running in deficient mismatch repair immunotherapy. One's dostarlimab and one is pembrolizumab versus chemo. They were designed before the results of the studies I just showed you. And so you'll notice that the control arm isn't chemo, IO, and IO maintenance. And so when these read out, there's going to be a lot of consternation around how we interpret the results, and does it mean that I don't need the chemotherapy? And the reason I say that is this. Again, for those of you that were at ESMO, saw this, if not, it was just published. This is the NICHE-2 trial, which is deficient mismatch repair colorectal cancer. I don't know what I was doing at ESMO, but I wandered in right as this was being presented and kind of plopped myself down. And I was so glad to see Dr. Chalabi present it. It was one of those like standing ovation moments. So this is neoadjuvant deficient mismatch repair colorectal cancer. This is their 3-year TFS with ipi/nivo for 2 cycles. I mean, really? So that's like amazing. Like, well, this amazing, amazing for deficient mismatch repair endometrial cancer. But are we the same? We haven't done that kind of study yet because we don't have a lot of neoadjuvant use, local regional endometrial. It's a different disease. But this study was just published, and it's a great study where they did the same thing. They did two cycles of pembro in a group of patients with deficient mismatch repair tumors who were going to undergo surgery. And all the patients but two had some reduction in their measurements and their pathologic response, but it doesn't look like this, does it? So there may be some sort of protective shell that the uterus has, and certainly in that case he presented, you know, if he got her to a point where you could, sometimes we take patients to the OR and take the primary out when they've had such an amazing response, we always find cancer in the uterus. And so I do wonder if uterus is the same here and if we're going to get away with IO alone. And so I would caution you to be an early adopter in all patients here until we really have the data. Special cases aside, we all do that. As a rule, I'm pretty solid on chemo IO here until we know more. The biomarkers are complicated. This is data on the upper left from Shannon Weston's work with DuoE, where they've done kind of the most robust kind of cross biomarker presence work. And the point is that these patients have more than one biomarker, and that makes sense. And so as we try to parse out, especially in the proficient mismatch repair tumors, who should and shouldn't get IO, I'm showing you at the bottom left, this is a subset analysis of RUBY in those tumors that were deemed TP53 mutated, which was done by shallow hole exome. And they have a hazard ratio of 0.41, which was kind of surprising. Like, why would that be? And everyone kind of jumped on that bandwagon. But in the upper right, this is DuoE olaparib durvalumab. You see hazard ratio 0.47. Their durvalumab alone did not show the same thing as RUBY. So we can't overinterpret subsets here until we have a little bit more data. So the devil's going to be in the details with the how and when of these biomarkers in mismatch repair proficient. And then we've been talking about HER2. We're testing all patients now for HER2, specifically defined for the recurrent setting, so we can use trastuzumab deruxtecan. There's a number of similar agents. They are amazingly effective. FDA approved in 3+, and you can see based on 13 patients, we need a lot more data here, but an 85% response rate in a recurrent case is kind of a miracle in and of itself. NCCN listed for 2+ and 3+, and we are using this medication with 2+ and up, and there's studies that are launching now that are 1+ and up, trying to figure out really who should be getting these antibody drug conjugates in lieu of other agents, and whether or not they should move up instead of IO in this population. So I think you'll see studies coming there as well.
All right, next case presentation, Dr. Lamar with comments from Dr. Beauchesne.
The next case is presented by Dr. Lamar with a follow-up question from Dr. Bocha. The patient is a 65-year-old woman with metastatic endometrial cancer.
She was MSI high. She was started on carboplatin paclitaxel with pembrolizumab, but unfortunately, at the end of 6 cycles, was found to have progressive disease. So she went to several academic centers, and the consensus was for her to continue pembrolizumab and to start lenvatinib. This was a little bit disappointing because I really expected her to have a very good response to immunotherapy. There are other medications, dostarlimab. Would you try alternative immunotherapies?
We could bring up the question of the use of IO therapy in patients who have other autoimmune disorders. I've had significant flares in a couple of patients who had rheumatoid arthritis and lupus. So which patients might not be a candidate? So we know that the use of IO drugs in a transplant patient is relatively, if not specifically, contraindicated. But some of these patients actually do have lethal diseases where their post-transplant status is actually pretty good. Which patients have you used IO therapy in patients who have undergone either solid organ or hematopoietic stem cell transplants? Which patient would you absolutely feel is there's a contraindication?
So those are great questions. I'm going to bip through them so we can get to cervix. So the use of the addition of lenvatinib to IO in tumors that have progressed on IO, a lot of people do it, and there's some anecdotal evidence that they're getting responses. So I don't know that it's wrong, but this is someone, you know, we have antibody drug conjugates, a number of them in play right now for endometrial cancer, and they're working quite well. So I would be looking at that probably long before I try to add lenvatinib to an IO. And there's really no data that rotating the IO matters. It's kind of like PARP. Unless it's a toxicity rotation, I can't say that I think one works better than the other personally. So I don't know that that makes a lot of sense. The question about patients for whom you can't use IO, you know, if they're not deficient mismatch repair and I have contraindications, I am not pushing the IO. I think like you, we've seen, I mean, they're a miracle when they work, but I have seen horrible complications from IO in patients who I wasn't going to cure with IO on clinical trials. And so, you know, if there's a risk and it's not someone that I'm going to cure, I'm going to talk to them about it, but I'm not taking that risk with a patient. You know, I've induced Guillain-Barré and other sorts of terrible things. So if they're deficient mismatch repair, we'll have that conversation and I will manage them with my medical oncology colleagues. We have an immune kind of task force of experts that I'm very fortunate to be able to weigh into, and I manage them with them very, very cautiously. And I have treated a patient post hematopoietic stem cell transplant with very close attention from my heme colleagues, and she did well. But I don't know that I would say just go do it. You know, it was pretty dicey. So
perfect.
All right.
I know we want to get to the cervical cancer stuff. So if you want to hit the high points on Ruby.
Let me just hit the high points on PARP inhibitors. We had two studies that incorporated PARP inhibitors with immune checkpoint inhibitors in endometrial cancer. One was called DUO-E and one was called Ruby. The kind of the impetus here is that PARP inhibitors causing DNA damage should increase cytosolic DNA, which stimulates the STING pathway. And if the STING pathway is upregulated, perhaps you will respond to immune checkpoint inhibitors in a setting where you otherwise wouldn't, like a proficient mismatch repair population. And so this was tested in DUO-E, which was advanced endometrial cancer who received chemo alone versus chemo plus DURVA and DURVA maintenance. So that was one primary endpoint, DURVA versus placebo. And then the second primary endpoint was DURVA olaparib maintenance versus placebo. Those were the analytic endpoints. DURVA olaparib versus DURVA was not an analytic endpoint, which we all wished that it was. But here you can just see on the top is the DURVA olaparib, and in the middle is the DURVA alone. Both of them were better than control statistically, and so this was a positive study for ITT. When you break it down by deficient mismatch repair, it is clear that there's no benefit to adding PARP to a deficient mismatch repair tumor, and you should not do this. They get all the benefit from immune checkpoint inhibitor alone, and all the benefit of PARP comes in a proficient tumor. And so now the question is that all proficient tumors? Is it just TP53? Is there a biomarker so we can really individualize to whom we give a PARP, if anyone in this setting, and I think there'll be more to come on that. The Ruby study also was similar, but it left off the dostarlimab alone arm. So it was dostarlimab, niraparib versus control, very consistent hazard ratios as to DUO-E in that arm 3 versus arm 1. So I think we can say consistent, but there's still a lot of questions about when and if we add PARP inhibitor and it's not currently FDA approved.
All right, next video.
The next case is presented by Dr. Mulhern.
She had been diagnosed 6 years ago with stage 3 cervical squamous cell carcinoma. She had definitive chemoradiation with weekly cisplatin, and she had brachytherapy, and she had a complete response. And then 2 years later, she relapsed with bulky retroperitoneal neolymphadenopathy and multiple pulmonary nodules. So she underwent a biopsy, so yes, it's squamous cell consistent with cervical primary, PD-L1 100% positive.
So I see she got Pembro, responded for a year, but then progressed and got the ADC tisotumab vedotin. How did that go?
So I don't know how many people have used tisotumab vedotin, but the eye care plan is intense. Our ocular educational level is about first grade. You start, I think, with the vasoconstrictor drops, and then you have to cover the face and the bridge of the nose with ice because you can get epistaxis from it. So you want to limit, you know, exposure to those areas. So that's a very unusual set of toxicities. That was a real barrier, especially in the rural clinic where I was seeing these patients. The nurses had never heard of it. So that was a problem. So I think maybe going over a little bit of that from the faculty.
So just in the interest of time, I want to kind of move forward to slides on the antibody drug conjugate, because I think everybody's super interested in hearing. You have some phenomenal slides on, updates in cervical cancer and where we've been. Those are in the iPads for everyone. But if we can get to the ADC here.
Right. So currently ADCs are in this second line metastatic setting. Patients should have received paclitaxel carboplatin, potentially bevacizumab, and an IO in that first metastatic setting, which does improve PFS and OS, but unfortunately they all recur. And then what we had here, if I have a little build, in the red is what we've had forever, which is pick your poison, and it is poison, pemetrexed, Abraxane, Gem, whatever you like. And this is the response rate, it's 5%. That was our standard of care until tisotumab, which did complete a big phase 3 study. This was presented at ESMO last year. OS was the primary endpoint, and it was statistically and clinically positive. And so this really, it wasn't designed as a post-IO therapy, but by default, it has become sort of the first-line post-IO therapy for patients with an improvement in overall survival. And the eye care plan that is true. Patients have to wear an eye mask that's cooling. They have to use vasoconstrictive drops, lubricating eye drops, and they have to see an optometrist or an ophthalmologist each cycle for the first 8 cycles to assess for conjunctivitis. So it does sound daunting, and you can talk to me later. Our patients do it, though. They want to live. And so they are incredibly graceful in getting this done and participating, and they are able to stay on this medication with very few discontinuations due to ocular side effects. But this is our newest best standard of care, and we can clearly do better. So this is FDA approved. There's a number of ADCs in development here, but we do have approval for trastuzumab deruxtecan in 3+ FDA. Again, NCCN, it's 2+ and 3+. We used to think this was only an adenocarcinoma opportunity for HER2, but now that we are testing broadly, we are finding squamous cell that do express, have HER2 IHC. There are studies ongoing right now that are 1+ and up, and we are seeing responses. And so watch for this. I think this data is going to sort of evolve as more than 40 patients are treated with this class of agents, but you want to find your HER2 positive cervix tumors and get them access to this medication. Again, it is NCCN listed, and I don't know if I can say this, but I've been able to get it for 1+, making the argument that there's nothing else available, and we are seeing efficacy. And so this is an important add-on. And I'll just say the other one that's coming, and there's a phase 3 study running now called TroFuse, is sacituzumab turumatecan targeting TROP2, which is 90% expression on squamous cell, the vulva, and cervix. And so we're excited about that one as well. So ADCs here are set to transform the stage for cervix cancer. This is just from Destiny Pan-Tumor. And again, this is tiny numbers, but just to show you what we don't know, we don't understand who to use this drug in yet. These are all the centrally reconfirmed. You can see of 40 patients, 8 were 3+, and a 75% response rate. It's amazing. 2+ is 40%, but even those that were centrally confirmed 1+ and 0 still at a 50% response rate, but these numbers are tiny. So we just need to continue to do trials and build this database so we really have some sense of who should get this and maybe who should not. And these are just the PFS curves by scoring. This is the ITT from Destiny Pan-Tumor. Here's the 3+, which is only 8 patients. And then here's the rest below. So there probably is some dose response to the expression, but this is only 40 patients. And again, I sound like a broken record. We have a lot of work to do to figure this out.
Yeah, but I think it's evidence of there is no original human thought, you know, right? I mean, these are a lot of borrowed ideas from other disease states. Yep. We're super excited to see the TDXD data in the GYN space. I mean, Quick question for you. What are your thoughts on, you know, sequencing post, you know, immune checkpoint inhibitor on TISO and subsequent therapies relative to, say, TDXC, depending on IHC expression, et cetera?
So sequencing, yeah, sequencing is really in our faces right now. By virtue of how the regulatory environment is, the studies in the kind of recurrent setting are all going to be post-IO. I do think, though, you know, if I had a patient who's eligible for Len-Pem or trastuzumab deruxtecan, that's a hard decision for me. I've actually faced that, and I've put them on the ADC first. It's just better tolerated, and I feel like it can be more active than Len-Pem, which is just, for us, kind of difficult to manage. I think medical oncologists are much more facile with TKI management, but lenvatinib for us has just been tough. Like, it's just a tough drug. So I tend to put it ahead, but we really need some sequencing work, because the other thing that we're seeing, especially in ovary, where we're using deruxtecan and microtubule ADCs and a whole bunch of other things, is if you cause grade 1 pneumonitis and I get it to resolve, I've excluded that patient if she got steroids from everything else down the line. And so we're also figuring out sequencing for kind of side effect management, so we can make sure we have all the medicines lined up for our patient to prolong OS and not disqualify her from things down the
absolutely pipe. Great point. When you start thinking about IOs, ILD, ADCs, right. Everolimus can do the same.
Exactly.
And you start thinking about these things and trying to sequence
exactly.
it to, you know, A, do no harm, but B, provide the best benefit. And the hazard ratios, you know, that you showed earlier, 0.28 are just crazy, right? So we don't want to miss those opportunities.
Exactly. Yep.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate your expertise and wisdom and insight today. I know it was a huge, thick topic to cover, but I thought you did a phenomenal job.
Thank you.